if you get fresh milk from the supermarket that just got brought in by the truck and they're not a nefarious group that holds on to stuff, and you buy 50 of the regular whole milk cartons and 50 of the organic whole milk cartons, at the end of the race, are there going to be any more organic milk cartons that aren't boiled than there is in the group that's not organic? Anyone have any opinions on this particular subject?
Going to be a milky answer.
Well, I would expect it to be. It's a milky question.
I would say the non-organic, because they put more protective chemical devices in there to make them stay fresh longer.
Okay, makes sense. Unfortunately, in this case, it's not the correct answer. The point is, the surprising thing is, if you actually stood around in supermarkets and you saw the buy-by date for the just-delivered regular whole milk and the organic whole milk, you would see that there's a disparity. The buy-by date for the organic milk is at a later time than the regular. And the reason for that is because, as I think Ed mentioned, all milk has to be pasteurized, but they don't have to be pasteurized in the same exact way. Normal milk, they have two options. They'll either bring it up to about 145 degrees for 30 minutes, or they'll bring it up to 160 degrees for at least 15 seconds. That's the regular milk. The organic milk, by law, has to use something called ultra-high temperature processing, which means that they have to bring it up to 280 degrees Fahrenheit for 2 to 4 seconds. Now, this kills a lot more bacteria than the other method. It also... break a couple of the two sugar molecules in half into single sugar molecules, so the sweetness goes up a touch. Most people don't recognize it. But actually, that is why organic milk lasts longer. I used to have a problem keeping milk. No matter how fresh I got it, by the time I got to the last carton, it was smelling a little off. And I switched to organic and never had that problem again. So organic milk actually does last longer. It's not anything esoteric. It's just because the type of pasteurization that's legally required is more aggressive.
What about skim versus whole, or 1%?
I didn't look it up. I don't know if there's such a thing as organic skimmed milk. Do you know if there's such a thing as organic skim milk?
No, I'm talking about regular skim milk. Would that last? It seems to me that it lasts longer than whole milk or 1%.
Yeah, I think part of it, well, part of it kills most bacteria. They don't kill all the bacteria, so it's just you're playing a game of time and temperature with it. I think the fat content has an important factor in accelerating the spoilage of milk, so it's more likely, again, just making assumptions, that skim milk will last you longer than things with significant fat content.
On the other hand, I've heard an opposite story, Roy.
Yes, please, tell me, Ed.
This is second hand. A fellow I knew says he's researched and he found that half and half lasted much longer than regular milk. It had to do with, an office horse crotch. But he said he looked into it and found out the half and half lasts a lot longer than regular milk. Now, again, it's anecdotal. It wasn't me. But it's the exact opposite of what you just said.
Okay, I mean, I'm not basing it on anything that I know. Richard kind of threw me for a loop with the discussion of skim milk. I'm not an expert on skimmed milk. When I was a little kid, I remember the milk companies went on strike, and somehow I got stuck drinking powdered milk, and ever since that point, if I can't have whole milk, I don't drink milk at all, so I'm not a big fan of skim milk. You might be right. I don't know. Anecdotal stories are not really that useful to hang a hat on. But I'll have to go look and see if there's anything specific. I know for organic milk there was something really specific, and in my life it played out. It worked. I have organic milk. It's more expensive, but when I factor in throwing away cartons of spoiled milk, it evens out. Chris.
Just happened to cheat, typed it in on Google, and it does look like half and half lasts longer, and the reason they give, I don't know if it's true or not, but the reason it looks like is the bacteria that spoils milk is mostly in the water that's in the milk. So half and half has less of the water, there's less of the bacteria, which is interesting. And as a side note, I've recently been drinking the grass-fed milk in my coffee and espressos, and I find it tastes a lot better. However, it does come at a cost. It's twice the price. K2SDP.
Well, if you can afford it, so be it. Yeah, I don't know. I don't exactly go into details of what the organic is. My reasoning is purely that I could hold on to it longer. But if you like the taste, and certainly there's a whole industry of grass-fed cows, not only the milk, but you can get more expensive beef. By buying beef that's butchered from cattle that ate grass instead of just the stuff that they feed every commercial animal in their farm.
On the other hand, I believe there's an issue with marbling recently grass.
A slight difference to me anyway, but the milk I find has a huge difference in flavor. I'm not doing it for health reasons. I'm not into the whole organic thing, but it's just grass-fed milk, it's called. It's twice the price, but it does have a lot of flavor. It's good stuff.
And it's still cheaper than Starbucks.
Almost everything is cheaper than Starbucks and probably tastes better than Starbucks.
WA2MHL. My name's Bob.
Yes, Bob.
Listening to all this about organic this and organic that, I honestly believe the whole title of organic is no.
Okay, Bob, you cut out at the end. I think you were going to say that it's all a con. And I don't know if it's all a con. I'm sure some people are playing games and not giving organic when they attack on that title. Once again, my primary purpose in buying organic milk is simply it requires them to use a different pasteurization technology that lasts a lot longer. So even if it's not truly organic, as long as they pasteurize it the right way that I want it to be, I consider myself having been served.
Consumer Reports has done articles on that subject, and apparently it is not yes or no, but a whole spectrum of options and answers.
Unfortunately, Bob, you dropped out of the repeater again. My understanding is that it's a little different. The type of pasteurization that's required of regular whole milk, from my understanding, is either 145 degrees Fahrenheit for 30 minutes, or there's a high temperature variation which amounts to 160 degrees for at least 15 seconds. As far as organic whole milk is required to be pasteurized using a different thing called ultra-high temperature processing, which is 280 degrees Fahrenheit for about 2 to 4 seconds. So they are different. I mean, if you want to suggest that some of them flim-flam and don't do what they're supposed to do, I guess that's right. But in my experiences, I have noticed a difference both by the buy date and by the time period that I could keep it in my refrigerator without being bothered by it getting bad.
Thank you.
Also, Roy.
Yes, Ed?
Consumer Reports has written extensively on the subject of the different variations and options of organic and that kind of stuff. And it's like a whole spectrum. You can find stuff all over the map in what they call it, how good it is, and there's excellent stuff, there's terrible stuff, and all points in between.
For relationships, it's complicated. There's legitimate things, there's illegitimate things, there's partially legitimate things. Again, I'm sort of goal-oriented. I'm not really that interested in the minutia. I just kind of locked in on the pasteurization process, and it sounded like a good way to go. That's all. I'm not presenting it for everyone. You make your choices in this life. Anyway, it's been a pleasure, people. The puzzle, I think, worked for tonight, so maybe I'll go look it for some more at some later TechNet. I want to thank everyone who participated tonight with questions, with comments, with observations. Of course, Andy, WA2CDL with Andy's Corner. And now is time for our SpaceNet report with Paul WS2N. Take it away.
Very good, Roy.
And this is WS2N, Paul, for the SpaceNet report. And quite a few things have happened in the last 2 weeks, if you weren't here last week. But just recently, yesterday, Vice President actually got on and talked to a ham in space, I-5BKC, which is Victor Glover. He's one of the 7 people flying around on the International Space Station. And Kamala Harris had about 5 minutes talk with him. And he was transmitting from the Kaibo module, you know, the Japanese module. That's what, you know, anytime you see an interview, that's the one that they're usually in. They have a camera set up there permanently. And their microphones and all. That's where you usually see the any interviews anytime a news station is calling or something like this. So I thought that was pretty good. Let me drop it. Okay. Also, this morning there was an EVA, a spacewalk, by 2 hams, and one of them is Kate Rubin, and she's KG5GYJ, and along with the same fellow that was talking to Kamala Harris, Victor Glover, KI5BKL. You know, and he had just finished up on a spacewalk the other day. In fact, he did 2, and then sure enough, this morning these two. Victor went out on another spacewalk and almost 8 hours. It was very long. The idea is to upgrade or increase the amount of power that they get from the solar panels. These big massive solar panels they make up the biggest area of the space station. From one end to the other end, you cover a football field. So they are starting to degrade over time. They were really meant for 15 years, and some of those panels have been up there for that long. But now they're going to be they're going to add to them. They're not going to take them away. They're going to start to add to them with these other solar panels. They're called ROSA panels, roll-out solar arrays. And it's a different design than typical solar panels. Usually they open up as panels and they're hinged and they're big and heavy. And this is a new design that's been tested in space. They sent it up a year or so ago, a smaller version of what they're going to do now. And essentially they roll out the two long tubes on the side, left side and right side of the solar panel. And as they roll out, they're compressed when they put them in, and they automatically just roll out with no nitrogen behind it or no motor or anything. It's just relieving the strain of this. Of like a rolled up, like if you took a hose and rolled it up, it would tend to roll out, when you furl it. And it stretches out these new panels. And the new panels that they're installing nowadays are twice as efficient as, 15, 20 years ago when the original ones were designed. So they only have to be about half the size of the existing ones, and yet they're going to put out even more power. Anyway, by the time they're done, right now the existing power is around 160 kilowatts, and it's going to bring it up to around 215 by the time they're done. That's going to take a couple of, two and a half years, I think, to finish this. They're going to take many spacewalks, probably about at least 8 spacewalks to do this. They worked on one. There's 4 main sets. They're going to do this to 3 different sets over the years. And this is the first set that they were working on. And right now, they just set up the struts and the pieces that are going to be attached to the main base of this one area. And then from there, they're going to, maybe next year when they actually send the solar. Rolled up solar array up. At that point, they'll eventually attach it to the base that was put on today and have it roll out. And this will be done, like I said, probably over the next year or two. But, it's an improvement. They've been up there a long time. It's time to improve on those. Over the last 3 years, they've changed out all the batteries, and they switched from nickel hydrogen batteries to lithium ion batteries. Again, half the size, half the weight, and equal power coming out of those batteries. So it's an old space station, but it's getting improvements all the time. Okay, if anybody has any questions about that, let me know, right? And so I'm going to go on to Perseverance, the Mars rover. Okay, Perseverance is the Mars rover that landed successfully last week. It launched 6 months ago on an Atlas V rocket from Launch Complex 41 in Florida. It took all this time to get there. They didn't go into orbit. They just you know, had a direct shot right in. It went in around a 15-degree angle, and the idea was to get to Jezero Crater. That's their goal. Jezero Crater is a spot that all the scientists would love to go to because they, there's an old delta there, they can tell from the orbital pictures. And the idea is if you can get near a delta, you can find maybe fossilized bacteria or something in the rocks. But to pinpoint that, it was very difficult. Last rover we sent up was Curiosity, and this one had about 10 times more the accuracy of actually landing in that spot. And it turns out they were only a few meters off from where they planned on landing, but they were successful in doing that. And they came through the atmosphere fine, you know, the cruise stage separated, heat shield heated up as it was entering the atmosphere, as they slowed down enough and they didn't need the heat shield anymore, that would eventually pop off. But they had this parachute that popped out, 70-foot diameter parachute, and it slowed down more. And then finally the heat shield pops off when it gets a little lower to the ground. And from that part, from that location, the radar can pick up the ground and they can see where they are. And then they had another system of cameras taking pictures as they're going down. Cameras were sending that information into its own computer and comparing it with existing pictures that were preloaded into the spacecraft. And it could tell where it is. And it has the ability to move in space, different directions to try to zoom in on Jezero Crater, which it was doing. And then at some point, the next big move is to separate from the back shell and the parachute. They just dropped the rover. The rover is attached to a sky crane, so it just drops, it's heading toward the ground. The eight rockets come on the sky crane to slow it down even more until it eventually gets close to the ground, maybe a couple hundred feet off the ground. And then at that point this cable, there's three nylon cables that start dropping the rover from the sky crane, and it drops down around 50 feet from the sky crane, gets closer to the ground. And then they have a touchdown. The second is the sky crane senses that that there's now less weight that's holding it up. Automatically sets the signal. The pyrotechnics go up on the top of the rover, wearing the three nylon straps that were holding it from the sky crane, and also another nylon cutter. Pyrotechnic cuts the cable and data line that was also coming down from the sky crane. Sky crane is rockets are still firing. It flies away, half a mile or a mile away from the landing spot. And everything turned out to be good. They checked everything. They started to get pictures back right away. They ran some tests with Ingenuity, the helicopter that's on board, and that thing checked out okay. It didn't, separate the helicopter from the rover yet. That'll probably take about a month. The news conferences, and at one point, I think it was Monday, last Monday, they had the one news conference where they showed the video. First time they've actually had video from the landing, and they had cameras all kinds of cameras. They were dropping down, they had cameras looking up to see what the parachute looked like, see how that thing looked. And they had another camera looking down to see the sky crane drop out of the back shell.
the sky crane itself had cameras looking down at the rover. The rover had cameras looking up at the sky crane. It's pretty incredible. So they put it all together last Monday, and they sequenced the time with Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Okay, 1 second. And now the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, when you watch it live, you know, they don't see anything. They're just seeing signals come back from the rover at this landing. But they matched the video up with Jet Propulsion Laboratory last Monday to make it look like that's what they were seeing, you know, as it was happening. And it was a very good minute and a half video from parachute opening up to actual landing. The other station, go ahead with questions. This is WS2I.
WB3AD. The sky crane, after it's decoupled, does it fly away until it runs out of fuel and fall and crash, or is it something a little more elaborate? Does it actually land?
Yeah, it just runs out of fuel. They have it designed to not only go up, but on an angle. They direct it away from the rover. The last thing that they want to do is have it go straight up. And, you know, when it runs out of fuel, come down into the rover. So they purposely angled it. I didn't get a report of how far. I saw pictures of what it looked like. It looked like it was about a half a mile away. They showed aerial pictures of where the sky crane wound up and where the heat shield wound up and all of that, and including the parachute as well. Back to you.
All right, so you're saying there's no attempt to land. They just have to fly away, run out of fuel, crash.
Yes, that's what they did. And they did the same thing with Curiosity back in 2012 when that thing landed. That had the sky crane system as well. Yeah, that's what they do. They don't need that anymore. I'd like to see them have the rover ride over to it eventually and look at the sky crane, you know. I mean, you could theoretically do it, but they won't. The scientists are interested in traveling around that delta run on Jezero Crater. Anyway, the plan for the rover is the next 30 to 60 days is to eventually move the wheels a little bit, go forward, go backwards, see if it turns out okay, and eventually they're going to, I think one of the first things they need to do is get rid of this helicopter that's bolted to the belly of Perseverance. Helicopter's name is Ingenuity, so it's kind of like laying on its side on the bottom of the rover. Eventually, it's got this dust cover protecting it right now. That'll be popped off, and they'll move to another another little location. And then they'll be able to actually have the rover drop down. Legs will pop out. They're spring-loaded legs. They'll pop out. They've got four legs on it. And then they'll release it. It only has to drop four inches or so before it hits the ground. And then after that, the helicopter is on its own. Right now, it's being powered by Perseverance. At that point, it will be on its own. It has its own solar panel on top of the blades, 4-foot-long blades. We were trying to figure out how fast these blades were going. I did finally find the answer on that. It's 2,400 RPM. So it's really moving pretty good. And the end of the rotor blades is a little bit below Mach 1 for sound. Well, it'll be interesting to see if it flies. They have plans of eventually flying around five different times. The rover, of course, has cameras all over. I think it's got like, well, collectively, the whole, everything has 23 cameras. The rover's got plenty of cameras. It will be looking at Ingenuity when it takes off. And Ingenuity itself has two cameras on board, so it'll be able to see where it's going and maybe even pictures of the rover as it's flying around. They have flights planned five different times. Then they did say it's got a range of around 3,000, or a little over 3,000 some odd feet to transmit the information back to the rover. So I guess if it goes too far away, the rover will have to drive closer to it to pick up the signal when it transmits its data back to the rover. Once the rover gets it, the rover transmits it back up to mostly MRO, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, but it could transmit to the other satellites that are in orbit of Mars if they had to. You know, that goes up UHF and then transmits back from the orbiting satellite on X-band, probably around 8 gigs. Any questions or comments? Okay. Last week I wanted to talk about this new four-person crew that was going to be picked, which they finally did. Drop. Right now you have seven people on board the space station, which have four of them went up many months ago with the Dragon crew vehicle, and they happen to all be hams, by the way, the four that went up there. And eventually their schedule will come back, probably this April. So right now you have a flight planned for April 20th of a new crew that's going to go up. I don't know if the old crew is still going to be there or not when the new crew goes up. They're scheduled to join a group. If they do, they'll wind up having 11 people on the space station temporarily. You have Shane Kimbrough, another ham, KE5HOD. You have Akino Hoshi from Japan, KE5DNI, and Thomas Piquet from England, KG5FYG. Yeah, you have a fourth one, but she is not a ham. That would be a Megan McCart. She's married to Bob Behnken. Bob Behnken is a ham, KE5GGX. He went up not too long ago with Bob Hurley. Bob Hurley was not a ham, so you had 50% of that crew. That was just the first two-person crew to go up in the Dragon spacecraft, the first test flight to the space station. Mexico. But the plan for this crew is all crews is to land in the Atlantic Ocean. The Gulf of Mexico is a backup if it's too windy or bad weather or too many waves. So it'll be good to see this crew to get up there. They'll stay for around 6 months. So that's what the capability is. And very interesting to see how SpaceX has come along. But soon there's going to be another vehicle that will be launched, and that will be the Starliner. About a year or so ago, Boeing tried to launch their Starliner. Starliner eventually will carry a crew of four as well to the space station. So they were all ready, they wanted to send a test vehicle, an actual crew vehicle up without a crew and dock with the space station. It would be like 2 Decembers ago. So that was the goal. they made it to space. They launched on an Atlas V rocket from Launch Complex 41 in Florida. Got up into orbit. And when I say they, there was nobody on board. Went into orbit, and then they had computer problems. It turns out the computer on the spacecraft was different than the computer that was on board the second stage. And there was a mismatch between the timing. They had all kinds of problems. The spacecraft thought it was in a different location, so it kept firing thrusters trying to get back to where it thought it was supposed to be. And they had a lot of other problems. They said eventually they had to fix 82 different problems with Starliner. They didn't lose the spacecraft. They finally deorbited it, had enough fuel to do that, and it landed on land. Starliner is designed to land on land. Landed in White Sands, New Mexico. So, and then eventually that's where your crews are going to come back. Actually, they have five different landing places in the United States that they could land. You know, again, in case one has bad weather. Anyway, they've made all these repairs, and in a couple of weeks, April 2nd, they plan on launching the same idea. They're going to send an unmanned Starliner crew. Boeing will launch April 2nd, and hopefully it makes it all the way to the space station, docks at the space station autonomously, and eventually comes back. If that happens, they will eventually start sending crews up shortly after that to the International Space Station. So hopefully we'll have two vehicles and two different rockets that have the capability of sending astronauts into space from the United States. Any questions or comments? WS2M. The China mission, I was going to tell you this last week too, but we weren't here. It went into orbit actually right before Perseverance entered the atmosphere a few days before that. And, you know, they have a mission now in orbit around Mars. Called the Tianwen spacecraft. It's an orbiter. In May, you're going to have a separation from that orbiter with a lander. The lander will go down to land on Mars, and then they also have a rover on that as well, solar-powered rover. Perseverance and Curiosity, nuclear-powered. They have radioisotope. Electric generators, thermal electric generators in them. China has solar panels. But anyway, they keep everything pretty much top secret over there, and it's sometimes hard to figure out what they're saying. You know, it's happening when it's happening. So they didn't have any live transmissions that we could see anything or anything like that. But it turns out there's one ham in British Columbia. This guy, Scott Tilley, T-E-7-T-I-L, he's got a thing for, looking for spacecraft. Done this type of thing before. But he was able to copy the X-band signal from that China vehicle, from Tianwen, before N, as it went into orbit, and the figure from the Doppler shift, noticeable Doppler shift, at the predicted time when it was supposed to go into orbit. So he was pretty much able to confirm that. So here we have a ham doing that. So that's the story on China. But we'll see if they're successful. If they are, they'll join other countries that have not only orbited the Mars planet, but also sent landers down or rovers. Right now, we're the only ones that have successfully done rovers. We now have five in a row. So we started off with Pathfinder, which landed 97, and also had the Sojourner rover in it that I was successful. It was the first one from the United States, and then the twins, Spirit and Opportunity, landed in 2004, and then so that would be three, and then the fourth one was Curiosity, 2011, and now of course Perseverance. Next rover we send, as far as I know, will be the one that will land in the same place in Jezero Crater. And the idea of that one is to seek out and find all these different tubes that are going to be laying around the planet that Perseverance is going to drop off. Perseverance has this 7-foot robotic arm with all kinds of equipment at the end, including drills and core drilling device will drill into rocks instead of just pulverizing like we've done with all the other missions. They'll get core samples out of these different rocks, and they're going to place it inside this test tube-like device, and it's going to seal it, and it's going to leave it on the surface of Mars. This other rover that will eventually come up and pick them up many, many years from now is actually being developed right now by the European Space Agency. They're partners with us on that, so they're developing this rover. Much smaller rover than Curiosity is the biggest, was the biggest one, and now Perseverance is even bigger. Perseverance on Earth is 2,250 pounds. The one that goes up for the European Space Agency is very small, and that will drive over to pick up all these tubes, put it into a cache that it has attached to its body. After collecting up maybe up to 20 or even 40 possible samples, it'll drive back to where it landed, and it's going to have this system of putting this whole cache set up into the body of this lander, which will eventually put it in. The lander's got all kinds of robotic arms. It's going to put it into a rocket that have landed with this thing. The rocket will blast off. The solid fuel rocket will blast off from Mars, taking the samples into orbit, meeting up with another spacecraft that we haven't sent to Mars yet, that will be in orbit. Looks like it's going to do an EVA from what I saw the animation. It's going to, this sample cache is going to separate
time complete
from the sample return rocket, and it's going to float over and be caught by this orbiting spacecraft. After entering the orbiting spacecraft, that's got all kinds of gadgets and doorways, and it's going to push it here, push it there, and eventually it's going to push it into a sealed descent module. It's going to be able to withstand the temperatures of re-entering the Earth's atmosphere. So that will ignite its rocket and deorbit Mars and come back to Earth. And don't look for this to happen anytime soon. I'm looking at probably 10 years from now. If you're a young engineer, who knows, you might be working for JPL or European Space Agency developing this thing. And, 10 years from now, you might be one of the young engineers getting ready to find the, open up the test tube of the samples that this year, starting probably within a couple of months, Perseverance will be collecting. This is WS2N. Any questions or comments? Okay, nothing heard. it was a Progress vehicle that had been launched by Russia. The reason I want to bring this up, I mean, they've done literally probably 100 of these things. Well, you know, not 100 launches, but, you know, I think they're up to 77 Progress launches. Progress launches is all cargo, but it's launched by the same rocket that brings up the Russian Soyuz spacecraft. So it's a Soyuz rocket that launches the Progress vehicle. Anyway, that got off the ground successfully last week, and it was supposed to eventually dock with the International Space Station on the Russian side, the American side. We have four docking locations on the American side. They have four docking locations on the Russian side. So it was going to dock with one of those, and they do all their docking autonomously, like we're starting to do with Dragon and with Starliner. They don't need a robotic arm to grab it. It's 50 feet away from the space station, like we do with our crew vehicles. It comes up and docks automatically to one of the ports. And now this was all supposed to be televised, but due to the cold temperatures and the disaster that they had down in Texas, people were really not available. They canceled the televised transmissions that Houston would have carried. They usually carry, all the transmissions of Progress with Soyuz docking with the space station, but not this time. And it turns out it was gonna dock autonomously. It got close, but then it wound up with some problems. So they couldn't do it. The Russians have a backup system. Russian cosmonaut was able to. He's got a location in the Russian side, and he's got joint controls. He can control the Progress vehicle as it's coming in for docking. As he looks at the screen, he looks at telemetry, as if he's sitting inside that Progress vehicle. And he was able to dock it manually, which I was glad to see. Docked to the Piers module. Russian has these four docking, three docking modules. The Piers, the Razvet, and the Poise. This one docked to the Piers, which is the Earth-facing, one of the Earth-facing modules. And the reason this is important, they're going to unload the cargo and everything that they normally do from the Progress vehicle. But within probably, I think, a couple of months, they will want to deorbit it, which is what they usually do. They put trash inside, and it usually deorbits and burns up over the Pacific Ocean, the South Pacific Ocean. But this time, the goal is to actually disconnect the Piers module that it's attached to. They want to disconnect it, and that port will now be open. And both the Piers and the Progress vehicles, now filled up with garbage and trash, will both burn up over the South Pacific. So that leaves that port open. And the idea is for the Russians, they're going to be sending up a new module, a very large module. I think it's around 43 feet long. And, they planned on sending this thing up 12 years ago, but due to technical issues and finance problems, it's been delayed year after year, but now they believe they're going to be able to launch it probably this summer, I think. And they'll launch it on a Proton rocket. That's one of their big rockets, not the Soyuz rockets. And again, that will dock autonomously with the port that is left open to the Russian side of the space station. And if they do that, they'll have room for another extra Russian. They'll have another bathroom up there. They'll have another bunk, another sleeping quarters. And of course, it's really designed for a big science type of mission. The name of it is Nauka. And Nauka in Russian means science. So it's a science mission. Any other questions or comments? Good than that, this is WS2N.
Hello.
Okay.
That was the IT go by. Anyway, there was a, supposed to be a launch this evening. And it was a little after 8 o'clock that it was supposed to launch. And a few of us were watching it. And it was scrubbed at a minute and 24 seconds. It was in mission another 60 satellites or for the Starlink broadband computer program that they have going on at SpaceX involved, and they have now well over 1,000 satellites up in space. Their goal is to put a minimum of 1,400 up in space. But this was another 60 that was supposed to go. I don't know the reason yet for the scrub, but they will. Right now, the plan is to launch tomorrow. But I'm having a little hard luck with these vehicles. It was the eighth flight for this booster. As you know, they launched these boosters. Second stage, of course, is not reusable. That gets trashed, or, you know, eventually turns towards the atmosphere, and they ignite the engine again, and it burns up in the atmosphere. But not the boosters, 150-foot, 12-foot diameter boosters with 9 engines attached to it. They always land either on land, back on land, or mostly on these drone ships that he has out at sea, 300-500 miles out at sea. So that was the plan, and so that will have to wait until tomorrow. Last time they tried this, a week or so ago, it's about 2 weeks now, they were supposed to launch another 60 satellites, got off the ground, took off, second stage lit up, no problem, put all the satellites back into orbit, but the booster came back down and was supposed to land on one of these drone ships. And again, it was the eighth flight for that booster, too. It was supposed to be able to go at least 10 before any minor work had to be done, and then, you know, fly another 10 flights. Something apparently went wrong. They said they saw it light up in the sky, and it never came back to the booster. They did back to the drone ship. They said it got close, but, you know, naturally, I didn't see it. Just see it, you can see the light. It was a nice light. You can see it that got light in the distance a little bit. So that's the story. I hope they have a little bit better luck at SpaceX tomorrow. Any other comments or questions? If not, I'm going to turn it back to Roy to end the net for this evening. This is WS2N, and the name is Paul for the SpaceNet report for the Techno. Thing hard. We'll turn it over to Roy, ACTGS, WS2N, back to you, Roy.
Thank you very much, Paul. Thank you for everything that you do. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thanks to Andy of Andy's Corner. Thanks to all the people that participated tonight. And like I have always said, it's the participants that make or break any kind of a net, a technical net especially. So I do appreciate each and every one of you. And a special appreciation to the technical group that maintains the repeater and that will someday return the repeater sensitivity to what it once was. And my thanks to Lou for the emergency link on the UHF repeater. Without it, I couldn't do the TechNet tonight, so thank you, Lou. I want to remind everyone, as per usual, that if you have any questions and you can't get onto the TechNet, if you have any puzzles that you would like me to share with the group, if you would like me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at some kind of space-related story and discuss it, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. I have a whole bunch of interesting links. We didn't get to the science talk segment, but the articles are still there and interesting, and I hope you'll click on them and take a look around and see what I have selected for you. And that's available by just typing into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to my link page. And as always, anytime that you want to listen in to W2VL, when I can receive it, which is all the time at this point, thankfully, you just have to type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll give you a 24/7 feed for the time being. And remind everyone that Mike, AC2NJI, has a wonderful archive of technical nets going back all the way to September of 2006. His site is amateurradio.tv. And as always, I like to end these things with a bit of wisdom from one of the wisest men that I knew and know, Dick K2RIW. He used to end many of these by telling each of you to be kind to each other. And like I said before, it's good advice in general, and these days it's very good advice. The virus is still out there. The vaccines are coming. They're available. Please take them when they become available to you. Please maintain safe distancing and masking and washing your hands. Be safe. Be well. And we'll all meet again next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we do it all over again. So this is AC2GS, and I'll be clear. Be safe, people. Bye.
K82OGB, taking a listen into the last few minutes.
Yes, Greg, well, we wrapped it up for tonight. I'm on an emergency UHF link, thanks to Lou.
Yep, I listened for the last 5 minutes. Finished up with my shift, so hanging out down here in the basement here in Jamaica. I'm going to head on home. Hope everything went well tonight. Also, my schedule might be changing, so I might be able to listen here more often.
Okay, that would be nice, and maybe you can participate as well in the experience.
Not sure if you heard my phone go off, but just turned my notifications volume all the way down. Not sure why that had to go off while I was transmitting.
Yes, I heard it. I heard it. Craig, I think I'm going to go clear because I'm sure that Lou wants to break the IRLP link between the UHF repeater and the VHF repeater, and I don't want to give him any more work than he already has to do. So I'll bid you a fond adieu. We'll be back next Sunday. If you're able to make it, that would be great. Otherwise, worst comes to worst, you can always email me.
Yep, I'm always here. There is something I actually was looking into asking you. I just got to remember what it was. I'll get around to it. Take care. AC2GS, KD2OGD.
Fly Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
NASA. Time is 12:04 a.m. 73. And good night from the W2VL repeater. The time is 12:04 a.m. 73. And good night from the W2VL repeater.